The Mo's first interview today, it's with Arun Gupta. He's an investigative reporter, a writer, activist based in New York. Spends time here in Portland, a lot of time. Publishes a good deal, including in The Nation, Jacobin, The Intercept, The Washington Post, too. His latest book is Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. That'll be coming out later in early next year, I guess. Saturday, he was on assignment covering the face-off between this country's neo-fascists and Portland's various anti-fascist forces. I interviewed him yesterday at the KABU studio. Arun Gupta, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
This Saturday, Arun Gupta reported from within the neo-fascist and anti-fascist event. Spent most of his time with the neo-fascists as a credentialed reporter, allowed free access through the police lines. Arun, tell us why Saturday's events here were important nationally and even internationally, and give us a sense of the scene and what happened.
So I know this is may sound shocking to some, but the reason people need to be paying attention to what's happening in Portland, especially nationwide, is the extreme right is trying to turn Portland into its terrorist recruiting ground and training ground. So what we saw was extremists coming from all over the country. And by extremists, I mean white nationalists. At least three people were identified Saturday, August 17th, on the far right side, who had been in the deadly Charlottesville Unite the Right rally 2 years ago. In fact, we're pretty much right at the second anniversary of that. There was also members of the American Guard, which is variously described as white supremacists, neo-Nazi, the new Klan. They were there as well. It was mainly Proud Boys, which has become affiliated with violence. Even its founder called it a gang and said, we will kill you. They're known for being Islamophobic, homophobic, misogynist. I think the best description of them is what's called alt-left. They try not to be as overtly racist as neo-Nazis, but they have been linked to all sorts of extreme violent white nationalist movements. And so what they're doing in coming to Portland is trying to use the city to flex their muscle, to engage in violence. And it's essentially, it's a social media strategy. We have to understand kind of the whole context of what's going on here. Portland, liberal Portlandia, is kind of living up to a particular type of image. I often hear a lot of people say, why is this happening in Portlandia? It's supposed to be this quirky, gentle, loving town. And it's just like, well, it's also the whitest big city in America with this history where Oregon was founded as this white utopia and where it was illegal for blacks to even move into the state until 1926. This left behind a legacy of white supremacy that continues to this day. With Portland being the whitest big city in America, it's also been for decades, because of that racial homogeneity, a fertile recruiting ground, as the Pacific Northwest is in general, for all sorts of extreme right and white nationalist organizations. So that's the context that creates a weak civilian political leadership that is afraid to challenge its own police force, which has been pretty much colluding with the far right. We've seen great reporting coming out from the Willamette Week, the Portland Mercury, the Guardian, showing through all these internal documents they've gotten from the Portland police, how the police are colluding with, protecting the far right, facilitating their violence, and often then unleashing violence on counter-protesters. So the police are siding with these white nationalists who come out of town against the residents of the very town they're supposed to protect. And then you have a mayor, Ted Wheeler, who was told to me by someone who is he's worked closely with, that the mayor is scared of the police, that the mayor's office is afraid if they push on the police too hard that there'll be a police slowdown or strike. And this is coming from when in the mayor's own inner circle, and that basically there's a bias within the police department of support for Patriot Prayer and white supremacy. So this is why Portland has become the battleground. You know, we have to remember that this is not happening in any other city in the country. The far right keeps trying to go to other places, but they keep getting kicked out of D.C., out of Boston. There was a Proud Boys attack about a year ago in Manhattan where 10 of them were arrested. And in Portland, we've seen very few arrests up until the last couple of weeks. And one of the tragedies is this is because of El Paso. I would argue that the anti-Hispanic pogrom by Patrick Crugius, who released a manifesto using the words and ideas of Donald Trump, killed 22 people on August 4th. And finally, the police are cracking down in Portland, and the feds have also been not cracking down, but turning up the heat a little bit on the far right. So this is the context from what's going on in Portland.
Tell us what happened. They had, 400 to 600 people, which is pretty big for them. On the other hand, this had national and even international press and a number of right-wing talk radio-type pundits of the right were promoting it and pushing and asking people to come. They really wanted to have a signature event. It didn't seem to me that they made it. In fact, they sort of slunk away at the end, mostly just going up the Hawthorne Bridge and then asking the police to protect them, go up the Hawthorne Bridge and then take some buses wherever to Vancouver.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to recognize here is this was the largest mobilization of the extreme right so far.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take that many of them to wreak havoc in Portland. We saw that in June 30th, 2018, where they were allowed to engage in just these shocking open brawls, and maybe there were 100-150 of them. So this time I would say there were easily 500 of them. But because of all this fear, and because also the city and the prosecutor finally started clamping down, they started arresting a bunch of these Patriot Prayer guys who orchestrated an attack on Cider Riot, which is a bar on May Day, and they ended up assaulting a woman and fracturing her vertebrae. It took them 3 months, but after the El Paso massacre, the prosecutor and police started finally arresting these Patriot Prayer members. And this had been complete public knowledge. They were live streaming. Andy Ngo was live streaming. He's kind of like the inciter of a lot of this violence. There's a particular strategy also that's going on here. Joey Gibson was even admitted it back in 2016 to Katie Shepard of the Willamette Week, who really deserves a lot of commendation for her outstanding reporting over the years, in that their goal was to try to bait Antifa into getting into violence with the police, whereby that they would get videos that they would use on social media to go viral. And that's exactly what Andy knows. Does. He has a sense for how to take a video and then incite people. And that's what he's been trying to do in Portland in the last year. Basically, whoever he turns his camera or his social media on, it's a significant likelihood that they're going to become targets of harassment and death threats. I talked to 7 different people who he focused on in his work. One should never call him a reporter or a journalist. Basically, at best, he's a provocateur, but really what he does is engage in stochastic terrorism.
Right, but in fact, it seemed to me yesterday they didn't get what they wanted, at least in terms of the antifas in town, who, for whatever reason, spent a good deal of effort making noise. You were with the racists. Did they hear all of the commotion and the clamor in the background?
The guy who led the mob, Joe Biggs, he's affiliated with InfoWars. He had been taking to social media, saying death to Antifa, talking about murdering leftists, this right-wing meme, helicopter rides, which is a reference to how South American military dictatorships, such as Augusto Pinochet, would throw leftists out of helicopters to kill them. He displayed a weapon, this spike bat, that he said he was going to use against Antifa. And so then, about a week beforehand, the FBI finally paid him a visit, and so he got onto social media, and we need to tone down the rhetoric and leave those weapons at home. And so social media was just filled with ugly, graphic violence. And this is a big part of what's going on. You know, we have to understand that, you know, the kind of the hollowing out, the in fact, destruction of legacy media, as problematic as it was, it's far better than social media, because social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook, they absolutely do not care what is put on there. And in fact, it's the nature of the media, of social media. You know, it's, Marshall McLuhan is still right. The medium is the message. That kind of the most hyperbolic, dramatic statements are the ones that get paid attention to. And that draws more eyeballs for these platforms. So that's how they get their revenue. So they actually profit from the incitement, the propaganda, the lies that we've seen all these right-wing characters pushing out there. You know, Andy Ngo just being the latest one.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Arun Gupta, who's spent a lot of time in the neo-fascist ranks this Saturday at the event. We're talking about what happened there. He discussed, in fact, the change in the behavior of the police in Portland and, the FBI. They're starting to take right-wing violence maybe seriously. Arun, let's discuss whether this is really a serious change in their behavior, or is this a sort of tactical thing that they're doing? The right wing is, in fact, trying to infiltrate every part of the U.S. quote, public safety and security apparatus.
Exactly. The FBI had a report about this. You know, The Intercept has really been the publications that's been on top of a lot of this, where they said the white supremacists are infiltrating law enforcement. But, you know, the other issue is that law enforcement, it starts with slave patrols in the South. In the North, it began as anti-union militias. First, it was about catching runaway slaves and often instituting violent justice on the spot. Then they were enforcing Jim Crow laws, apartheid, for basically a century. So white supremacy is baked into police departments. Then there's also a sociocultural affinity. You know, you're talking about aggressive, violent white men who are tend to be misogynistic. And so it doesn't matter who a particular officer is. You know, it doesn't matter that Chief Daniel Outlaw is a black woman. That is completely irrelevant. It's the institution that is rotten to the core. And so we've finally seen some movement. And, you know, I pose this question to Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, Policing and Power in America. And he, I think, really nailed what's going on. And what we see is that historically, police allow extreme right violence a lot of latitude, and then some threshold is crossed, and then they finally start to pay attention. But in the end, the law enforcement agencies will allow that extreme right violence to continue far longer and to cause far more damage than it will to the left. So in the 1960s, when Northern white college students start to be killed, so since during the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Summer in 1964, the FBI starts paying attention to the Klan. In the 1980s, when violent white supremacists start a campaign of bank robberies and targeted assassinations, such as the radio talk show host Alan Berg, then the government starts paying attention to the Order and, you know, other violent white supremacists who are based in the Pacific Northwest. In the 1990s, after Timothy McVeigh bombs Oklahoma City and kills 168 people, then the government finally starts paying attention to the right-wing militias. So the problem, though, at this point, is it's not like you even have any sort of commitment to bourgeois democracy that you would have under past Republican presidents. Now what we see is Donald Trump. 2 weeks after El Paso, we have to remember, again, one of the really just horrendous things about El Paso in terms of the cause and effect was the right stopped talking about making Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. There is actually no such designation equivalent to the State Department's list, but Ted Cruz and other Republicans had been pushing it, and suddenly they went silent after El Paso. Now Donald Trump has started up again, but of course it's going to be harder to do now because obviously everyone is finally, especially the liberal media, is finally starting to acknowledge the real threat is white nationalist terrorists and these pro-Trump terrorists that he's creating by inciting them through mass communications. And this is what's known as stochastic terrorism.
Arun, thanks a lot for talking to us. We sort of have come to the end of the time. One final thing. It does seem to me, though, that in all of those instances that you listed when the police and the FBI began going after them, they were responding to, and the whole civil rights movement was that story, the cooperation with the Klan all over the South until public opinion became so strong that Kennedy and the others had to step in, force the FBI to do something because it was undermining his presidency at the time. It seems to me that an overwhelming response by the public for insisting on some kind of constitutional government will, in fact, change police behavior to some extent.
Sure. And you know, let me just finish with this point. So one can say after August 17th that it showed the Portland law enforcement agencies have the capacity to control the streets, which is what they're supposed to do when you have these violent right-wing extremists coming to town. But that begs the question, why did it take them over 2 years to do this?
We'll answer that another time, Arun. It was really good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
It was good talking to you too, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
There's a great and a bloody fight around this whole world tonight. In the battle, the bombs and shrapnel rain. Hitler told the world around he would tear our union down, but our union's gonna break them slavery chains. And our union's gonna break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky, could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world.